This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of November, and we almost have an election result. Joe Biden is on track to win the national popular vote by a solid margin on NBC Friday morning. Dave Wasserman from the Cook Political Report said he thought the final margin was likely to be around 6 or 7 million votes in Biden's favor once all the counting is done. And Biden is on track to win sufficient votes to win the Electoral College. As we tape on Friday, counting remains ongoing in most states, but most notably in Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden has taken the lead, and the inexorable march of mail votes is poised to give him an Electoral College win. Some of the decision desks have actually started calling this race for Joe Biden. Nevada is also highly likely to ultimately go Biden's way. Arizona and Georgia are closer questions. Down the ballot, Democrats appear likely to win a net of one U.S. Senate seat, which is not enough to take the majority, though they have an outside shot because of January runoffs that are likely to happen in Georgia. And Democrats are unexpectedly losing seats in the House of Representatives, though they are expected to retain a reduced majority there. To talk about what happened and what's next, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. And on the left is Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
And our special guest again this week is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and KCRW contributor. Hello, Gustavo.
Hola, Josh.
Okay, let's start with where I was wrong, because I was wrong about a fair amount. Now, I wasn't as wrong as I thought I was going to be as of 9 p.m. on Tuesday, but contrary to what I predicted, Joe Biden did not win Texas, he didn't win Florida, he is probably not going to win North Carolina. He won Wisconsin by much less than the polls said he would. Broadly, this election was just closer than I thought it was going to be. And I should not have been so confident. I read the polls and I believed them. The one instance where I disregarded the polls was in Texas, where I thought that some of the results about Biden's poor performance with Hispanics in South Texas, that looked implausible. And it turns out that was something that I should have believed the polls about. So in any case, I was wrong, at least about the magnitude of this victory. I shouldn't have been so overconfident. I'm sorry to a number of listeners out there who I've heard from, who felt that I got their hopes up too extensively. So I'm sorry about that, although winning ugly is still winning. And it looks like Joe Biden has won this thing. I want to go around and just get everybody's reactions to what transpired this week compared to what they were expecting. Why don't we start with Christine?
Well, yes, sorry to everybody whose hopes were raised. You know, I had been hopeful. Like, I think we all knew that this could become a close nail biter, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody was just really hopeful. And that was a mistake. And this week has been an extremely tiring shock. And I will refrain from being hopeful for a while in the future, perhaps. I am actually, however, very pleasantly surprised, perhaps, that even though this vote count has been extended, even though Donald Trump is making outrageous statements everywhere and his children are being even worse, Americans have mostly kept calm. All of this boarding up we saw in New York and DC seems to have been for naught. People are protesting calmly and respectably, dancing in the streets occasionally, and democracy seems to have at least survived. So that's good.
Tim, it's kind of funny. I've seen a lot of people saying, like, have we ever seen anybody so miserable to win an election as Democrats have been this week? And then similarly, on the Republican side, I'm not seeing the usual recriminations and infighting. Now, maybe that's just delayed, that a lot of, you know, the president certainly isn't admitting that he's lost. And I think a lot of Republicans have not yet processed that when these votes come through, it's really not going to be that close. And Joe Biden's going to be the next president. But what do you make of what we saw and how people have reacted to it?
Well, there's not the recriminations and infighting. In part, I think that's fitting. First of all, gaining seats in the House when you thought you were going to lose. I talked to National Republican Congressional Committee people back in September, and they said, I don't want to say this out loud, but we might break even. Okay, so they overperformed in the House. In the Senate, the odds are in favor of them keeping control of the Senate. And so then usually if a Republican loses a presidential election, there was some strategy, there was some establishment that said, trust us, do this, and we will win, or we will do as well as we possibly can. This time, there wasn't. Trump administration, Trump campaign is a tiger. It's like riding a wild animal. If it doesn't work out, nobody's shocked. Everybody was shocked that he won 4 years ago. This time his campaign manager flamed out and got hauled in by the police in the middle of the campaign. There's no establishment Damn. To blame and point a finger at of this loss. It was, oh gosh, look, this wild tiger just broke some windows. Shocking. Good thing that didn't happen 4 years ago.
Gustavo, what do you make of this?
Oh, boy. Where to start? Let's start by me saying that I was the one that got closest to the Electoral College victories, at least at this point with 306. But of course, I was completely wrong everywhere else. I thought Biden was going to win by a landslide. And he obviously, I guess at the end, he might win by a pretty healthy margin, but definitely not the landslide that I thought. I did predict that the Republicans would keep the Senate just because I figured that even if some Republicans wouldn't like Trump, they were still petrified at the idea of an all-Democrat Washington in the House and the Senate and the presidency. So that's going to put a big check on Biden. This goes back to your point about you've never seen such a miserable winner. And more importantly, or more sadly, I think, I predicted that do not underestimate the Latino vote, because the Latino vote will come and bite you if you do. And that's exactly what happened. There's God knows how many thought pieces right now about how the Democrats ignored the Latino vote, and that's why they lost Florida, but especially Texas. And then there's other people who are now saying, wait, you're not giving enough credit to Latinos because of Latinos, they definitely flipped Arizona to turning blue. They're probably going to get Nevada, and we'll see what goes on with Georgia. But all of that said, Trump made inroads, not just made inroads with Latinos, increase the score. And I think the Democrats and especially the Latino left will never be able to accept that. They're still going to make the same mistake that they've always done, which is dismiss them and ridicule them. And that part of the electorate, I guarantee you, will just continue to grow and grow.
I just want to note, as of Friday morning, I think Biden is probably going to win Arizona. The votes that are outstanding seem to favor the president. So I think Arizona is going to be very close. But I think, Gustavo, you're right that whatever happened in Arizona with the Hispanic vote, also with the white suburban vote, worked a lot better for Democrats than it did in Texas. When I look at what's happened in this election, the main thing I've been feeling is thank God we nominated Joe Biden. Because based on the returns we have so far, it looks like Biden ran up margins that were about 3 points better than the Democratic House candidates below him on the ballot were getting. And that extra crossover appeal, people who voted Republican in congressional races and then voted for Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, that is the difference between him winning and losing in states like Wisconsin that are going to be essential to his win in the Electoral College. And turnout was really high in this election, so I'm skeptical that some other Democratic candidate like Bernie Sanders would have brought out even more voters to the polls. And the story that polls told us all along, the part of the polls that I think we didn't listen to enough, was that voters were broadly satisfied with the economy and the president's handling of the economy, even in spite of COVID. And so Joe Biden has pulled off something pretty amazing here. He's beaten an elected incumbent. This is only the fourth time that's happened in the last 120 years. And he did it at a time when a majority of voters said they approved of the president's handling of the economy and that they felt better off than they did 4 years earlier. In September, 56% of respondents told Gallup that they were better off than they were 4 years ago, even amid this pandemic. And then Biden won anyway by appealing to the other problems with the president, the non-economic aspects of how he's handled this pandemic, his personal behavior, all those sorts of things. And he got voters to vote for him even if they thought the president was doing well on the economy. He got enough voters. And I imagine a general election with Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren at the top of the ticket, who would have tried explicitly to make the election about the economy and a different vision of the economy. And just what we know about how the president was polling on that, I believe Democrats would have lost if they had tried to turn this election into an election about the economy. I also don't know that a candidate like Amy Klobuchar could have achieved the gains in black turnout in major cities that Biden seems to have needed in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Georgia if he ends up pulling out a win in Georgia. So that's my takeaway after white-knuckling through this week, is that, you know, if Biden had blown it out, then you might have been able to say, well, any Democrat would have won this election. I think we're seeing the very specific advantages that Joe Biden personally had that were quite possibly the difference between Donald Trump being reelected and not. Christine, I'm wondering what you make of that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And when you put it that way, I do feel like a little bit more cheerful. So thanks for that uplift. As you pointed out, on the left, feel particularly disappointed by this election. But yeah, it is clear to me at this point that Joe Biden's centristness, his sort of reliability as, you know, that everyman figure in American politics, an older white male, actually made people comfortable voting for him. It does seem from our preliminary exit polls that, you know, the term socialist, you know, these sort of left slogans like defunding the police, et cetera, were turnoffs for people. And yeah, old working class, nothing's going to change. Joe was a person who actually reassured voters who might have been on the line that, you know, things aren't going to go that far. So maybe this is just a sign of what it takes in America at this point, especially in a moment like this, in a pandemic, in a moment of unrest. Perhaps the general population is not necessarily totally interested in, you know, a sharp rhetorical left turn or U-turn as much as we would like that. And as much as the policies that people support seem to reflect that, we still need a little bit of, I guess, calm edging towards change rather than a full-scale revolution. That said, I do think that we will have to take a look at exactly what policies did win. We'll note even in Florida, which Biden lost, the $15 minimum wage, as we discussed last week, won. There is interest in, you know, these more left-leaning, these more progressive policies that can actually change people's material lives for the better. The thing will be how to talk about them and sell them so that they don't scare people, which I think is what might have happened with had some of the other candidates actually run.
Tim, that's something that I hear a lot from Democrats, that when you look at the polls, you see that voters like Democrats' economic policies. When you look at results like this minimum wage referendum, that they support a lot of Democrats' economic policies. And yet those same polls also say that people think that Donald Trump and that Republicans are better at handling the economy than Democrats are. And so Democrats look at that and say, well, clearly we're not explaining ourselves well enough and we need to try again. Is that how you look at that, or is there something else that another way to read those polls that says that, you know, Republicans are actually selling something more popular than you realize by just asking about individual policies?
Well, first of all, Republicans see that minimum wage is popular. They've always known that that a higher minimum wage is popular, even if they think this might be bad economics, this might lead to unemployment. They know that it's popular, and increasingly, there are Republicans who see that economically moving left while socially staying right could be the winning formula. In some ways, Donald Trump is the closest thing we've had to the economically left, socially right candidate. Now, it's a bit laughable that this guy on his third wife, multiple affairs, is socially on the right, but I think you know what I mean, that he gave the pro-lifers what they want. He gave the conservatives their judges. So people like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio are trying to say, okay, how can we adopt, be more like Sherrod Brown on economics and the senator from Ohio, who's definitely a progressive, but without the weird identity politics, wokeness, and certainly the abortion extremism of the Democratic Party. So I do think that's something they'll be looking at in the future. Republicans trying to say, we are going to be socially conservative, but we're going to hew less to the sort of orthodoxy of free market economics.
Gustavo, as I look at these big regional differences in results, and there's been so much focus on South Florida and the president's gains in the Cuban community and in other Latino communities in Florida, gains in South Texas. You have other parts of the country where there wasn't that kind of movement, but then you do see it outside the southern tier of the country. Lawrence, Massachusetts, for example, which is a town that's or a city that's 80% Hispanic or Latino, 40% foreign-born, heavily Dominican. The president closed his vote margin there by 20 points. And I'm wondering what you make of in terms of the issue mix here, because there's a lot of different things you can see in the polling. One is that the Pew Research Center found earlier this year that Hispanic Democrats have significantly more pro-police attitudes than either black Democrats or white Democrats do. Down in South Texas, the Border Patrol is a major employer. The Border Patrol's employee force is heavily Latino. So what do you think were the issues that were the crossover? Is that where, you know, the president thought that all the policing and defund the police and the unrest in some cities, that was going to help him in white suburbs, where it doesn't seem to have played out that much? Is that a reason that the president improved his performance in Hispanic communities?
It all depends on where you're at. And this is the big fault of the Democratic Party for not only not realizing that Latinos are not a monolith, which at this point is already cliche, I'm sick of that one as well, but also trusting the people on the ground. So in Southern California, you are going to have, you know, more advocacy among Latinos to seriously examine examine what's going on with the police departments right now. But you're not going to have that as much in the border cities. Like, not, let's forget South Texas. Let's go to Imperial County, California. We're talking about Calexico, Brawley, where, yeah, one of the main employers is the Border Patrol. You might be the most left of left Latinos, but guess what? Your cousin's a Border Patrol agent. Your brother's in the Air Force. Your in-laws are sheriff's deputies and whatnot. So you can't go completely to the left. And you actually saw that in California where, yes, we elected Biden by, I think it was 66%, but we also rejected by a pretty good margin affirmative action, more rent control, and also, attempt to try to get more taxes via a partial repealing of Prop 13, which is the infamous California tax reform measure from the 1970s. So the Democrats didn't do that. In fact, the Democrats barely even tried to figure out what Latinos are. As usual, they assumed, okay, if you have a Hispanic surname, you obviously think Donald Trump's a devil, so we really don't have to do anything at all. Chuck Rocha, the guy who headed the Bernie Sanders campaign Latino outreach, he screamed and yelled throughout the election, hey, Biden, pay attention to what we have to say. We might actually be able to help you, especially in these swing states. Again, so let's not forget, though, that Biden did win the Latino vote and did win the Latino vote by a big margin, but not paying attention cost him a chance at Texas and definitely cost him Florida.
The flip side of this is that, you know, when there was the unrest in Kenosha earlier this year, there was this sort of national reaction to it, like, oh, this is going to be a big turning point in the campaign. There was all the unrest at various times in Seattle and Portland. And Christine, when I look at the returns by region, it looks like Biden is running significantly stronger in the Pacific Northwest than Hillary Clinton did 4 years ago. Minnesota is one of his real successes, where he seems to have improved really significantly over Hillary Clinton's margin in that state. I do not see the evidence that in places where there were mass protests over policing or in places where there was rioting and looting and significant disruptive unrest in downtowns, it does not seem that people bought Donald Trump's pitch about that, that you need me to crack down on this, that Democrats will let this be lawless and I will bring you the law and order that you need.
Right. That seems true. And I also think that even though there was some disruption happening with rioting and, yes, some looting, we also saw that people understood why that was taking place. And for the number of people that, you know, these protests might have turned off, there was also a good number of people who, you know, were awoken by these protests, who came to notice inequality, who were pressed to register to vote, to actually turn out to the polls to try and make a difference, if not to actually just stop the protests, actually stop the reasons why those were happening. And they felt that voting for a Democrat, voting for Joe Biden in this case, trying to take out Donald Trump, who has spent the last several months inflaming every sore wound in the American polity, might be the way to go. So in some sense, this railing about law and order and how terrible the protests were may have actually been, you know, working against Trump.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about COVID and the election. I've been talking with Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner, Christine Emba of The Washington Post, and Gustavo Arellano of The Los Angeles Times. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at The Los Angeles Times. So we've talked about a number of things that have influenced this election outcome. We talked about the economy and attitudes about it. We talked about these protests over policing and the unrest in some cities. We talked about appeals to various demographic groups. We haven't really talked about the pandemic. And I look at this election outcome and the way that this campaign went, and I wonder about the extent to which the pandemic actually mattered politically. I mean, the polls, you know, they were off in the end. I don't know that they were any less off prior when they showed Biden by winning by about the same amount before the pandemic happened. So, Tim, did the pandemic matter politically? Did it change people's minds about the president? Did it change the outcome of this election?
I think it mattered, and I think you could tell a story. I mean, elections this close, you could tell a million stories, but after the first batch of aid came through in the spring for businesses and individuals and families that were suffering, we had a deadlock. And who was guilty of not passing more money, more aid for schools that, say, want to open and need an HVAC system, more aid for restaurants that are shut down and probably going to go out of business? It was House Democrats and the Trump White House. So those are the two people who just got defeated most roundly. I mean, not huge defeats, obviously, but if anybody lost it in this election, it was Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. If anybody could have helped the economy a lot more over the summer and in the fall by acting like grownups, it was the House Democrats and the Trump White House. So I would say the response, the economic response or lack thereof, or the lack of follow-up on it, certainly, I think, plausibly determined our election.
I don't know that I buy that, because I mean, the president's big strength was his good numbers on the economy. I don't know that I think they would have been even better if another round of aid had been passed, in part because people's attitudes about the economy remained surprisingly sanguine even after the aid ran out. And partly that's because the economic recovery has been faster than it was expected. I'm watching next year for a lot of the economic commentators who sort of underrated economic performance the whole way through Trump's presidency because they kind of couldn't believe that Donald Trump, this idiot, could be presiding over this good economy. I'm interested to see how talk about the economy changes now that there's a Democratic president under whom we will probably stay on the same economic trajectory. Christine and Gustavo, do you have any thoughts on the pandemic and the election?
Sadly, I don't think it really mattered much, except unless you actually had someone who suffered from coronavirus or passed away. But even then, there's so much rationalization for each person's candidate, but especially with Trump. I honestly think with the Trump voter who might have not liked him, but still voted for him, it reminds me of that Simpsons episode when Sideshow Bob won as mayor of Springfield. And you had Homer saying, well, I don't really like Sideshow Bob's kill Bart policy, but I really love his kill Selma policy. And so people would just make these justifications like, oh, who cares if, you know, this country's divided or Trump is a misogynist or all these ugly things. I really like his stance on the economy. I like that tax cut. I hate the socialists. So that's what this election to me has boiled down to, really.
Interesting. I think Gustavo makes a really good point there. I mean, you could talk about how Black communities were disproportionately affected by coronavirus, disproportionately saw people die. Black communities were hurt economically and physically. And they knew that this was because Donald Trump did nothing basically to protect them or the country. And so maybe that made them even angrier and more likely to turn out for Democrats and for Joe Biden. And then on the flip side, you know, you see these white rural counties that were likely to be Trump-leaning anyway. And many of them, at least until very recently, felt that the virus wasn't as real to them. They weren't necessarily feeling as affected by it as people who lived in, yes, Democrat voting urban cores. They were upset about lockdowns and, you know, economic slowdowns due to coronavirus measures. And that made them react against it and maybe made them want to support Donald Trump, who would have left them alone, who wouldn't have changed their lives due to the fake virus anyways. And so perhaps that made them more likely to break for Trump. I do wonder, and again, I feel like we aren't really going to fully understand this or the data around this until perhaps much later, how much the just general insecurity and sense of fear, as we say, you know, different in different communities, made people either more open to voting for an alternative or made them more likely to say, well, you know, things are crazy right now. Let's just vote for the devil we know, I guess. I really do wonder, but I'm just not sure yet.
My favorite voter quote from any of the coverage of this election was, I believe, from a local reporter down in Miami who spoke with a 26-year-old man who had gone out and said that he had come to the polls intending to vote for Donald Trump, but that he decided to vote for Joe Biden because Trump was just, you know, making such a scene of himself and taking up so much attention. And he literally said, I want my Instagram to be about me and how good I look again.
The Instagram election.
Oh, America.
Which is incredibly shallow, but it gets at something that, you know, I certainly felt this, and I think a lot of voters did, that, like, Trump was just exhausting. And that it would be nice to not have to think about the president so much. I mean, I really kind of resent that for the last almost 6 years, I've woken up every day to think about Donald Trump. And I'm looking forward to not doing that. And I cover politics for a living. So I think that a lot of, you know, I wonder about the extent to which that sentiment just mattered. That Joe Biden, because he cleared this bar of acceptability for a lot of people, that there were, you know, that there were a lot of people who were willing to just go out and pull the lever for him, even if they were voting for Republicans down the ballot, just so that Washington would be a little bit quieter.
I think you're seeing that right now, that exhaustion, because yes, there are protests about ballot counts, either, you know, stop the count or continue the count, but they're much, much smaller than those humongous Trump caravans would have led you to believe.
And Josh, let me tell you what it's like to be a conservative under Donald Trump, a conservative journalist, that we see the president say something that is wrong, often idiotic, totally incoherent. And then we see the media pile on in a way that is misleading and unfair and biased. And we start to say, actually, your report's unfair and biased. And they say, are you defending Trump? And sometimes I have to say, no, I'm not defending Trump at all. I'm just saying that he's wrong in a different way than you're saying he's wrong. Guess what? That's not fun. That's exhausting. There is a sense of relief that I might be getting to defend a Republican bill in the Senate and attack Joe Biden. And that'll be a lot easier and a lot cleaner and a lot more tethered to reality than what we spent the last 4 years doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can even tell from my voice at this point that I am just totally exhausted by this situation. And I've said, you know, on this show for, I think, months beforehand, that at a certain point, I would have voted for like a paper bag blowing in the wind over Donald Trump, because at least I wouldn't have to talk about that flipping paper bag all the time. Jeez, you just want a break.
And so I think that's actually a good opportunity to turn and talk a little bit more about some of these congressional results, because, you know, conservative journalists are not that large a piece of the electorate, but we do see from these results that there were a substantial number of people who had an attitude that must have been somewhat similar to Tim's, who went out there, they voted for Joe Biden, and then down the ballot, they voted for Republicans for the Senate, they voted for Republicans for the House of Representatives. So, Tim, what did Republican congressional candidates do right here? Because 2018 was a really bad year for them. I don't think that was just about Trump. Their healthcare agenda had been very unpopular and it really hurt them in 2018. So what happened that allowed Republicans to improve their performance in those congressional races?
Well, I think that a lot of what happened was that 2018 was just an anti-Trump referendum, ironically, more than 2020 was. In 2018, the only way to vote against Trump was to vote for Democrats for Congress. And this time, people who were Republicans could go and vote for a Republican for Congress and then vote for Joe Biden or, as I did, vote third party, write in a vote. And in the states that he's losing narrowly, last I looked, if Trump had performed as well as those Republican members, he could have carried a state like Wisconsin. Again, numbers are still coming in. We'll see in the end. So I don't think there is anything exceptional. I think that we still basically have, if you add Trumpism to the sort of conservative Republican Paul Ryanist base, I do think you have a slight majority of the country. And this year, the Republican candidates were able to get the boost from Trump being on the ballot, but not the drag down of people who want to vote against Trump needing to vote against them.
Christine, the recriminations have started among House Democrats. Again, a group that is miserable to have won an election. They will retain the majority in the House, but a number of them were defeated for re-election. Abigail Spanberger, who is a moderate Democrat, she represents the Richmond suburbs in Virginia. She was narrowly reelected. She absolutely unloaded on a House Democratic conference call this week, saying that attack ads over things other Democrats said about socialism, about defunding the police, almost led to her loss and caused other moderate members like her who represent swing districts to lose this election, basically urging those people. It seemed like a message at AOC and the squad to knock this off because you're going to cost Democrats races in places that are much less safely Democratic than the districts that they represent. Obviously, there's been pushback from progressive Democrats saying, look at this big turnout among younger and progressive voters in cities that was key to Democrats winning this election. It seems to me like they both have points. that Democrats both, you know, they need to persuade these swing voters and they need to turn out in the cities. So what is the synthesis there? How do you do something that meets both of those goals when I think Spanberger does have a point that this stuff has hurt people in districts like hers?
Yeah, I have to say that that leak was grimly amusing, even to me, and doubly so because I grew up in the district that Spanberger represents, the suburbs of Richmond. And I can definitely see how in like a Democratic, but, you know, kind of conservative, I mean, Southern place, yes, calls for, you know, full socialism now, et cetera, are not really winning for people. I think, again, it's still a little bit early for the takes. And I think that may have been why this particular rant, you know, was so noticeable, because people are still figuring out exactly what went wrong. But as I said earlier, I think that this really will be a question of framing and phrasing for Democrats. I think that they're going to have to realize, or at least realize more, that at a certain point these days, a lot of voting is less about, you know, the policies, the nitty-gritty of what legislation you'll pass, and more about the slogans that people hear endlessly repeated on TV, on the radio, et cetera. And also, you know, like, yes, there are many progressives in the Democratic Party. Young people tend to be more progressive, but also the level of progressiveness that you see online, on TikTok, in certain circles may not, in fact, be representative of, you know, voters out there in the wild, the voters of suburban Richmond, the people who you need to convince and turn. And I do think that Democrats will need to, you know, continue to be more aware of their audience in a way that Republicans, I kind of hate to say it, but have done really well with messaging that could almost be propaganda, with the clear repetition of certain lines about not necessarily identity politics, but just about identity and culture, things that people can quickly identify with their party and love or like, not be scared by.
Gustavo, I thought Matt Iglesias had something interesting to say about this on Twitter, which was, you know, he understands why moderate Democrats in Congress are frustrated that progressive figures like AOC have such an outsized national profile relative to their actual level of control of the party. But that, you know, the solution to that is that these moderates need to try to build their own national profiles and set their own public image of what it is to be a Democrat, to be a Democratic legislator. And so I'm wondering if you agree with that, and then what that would entail for them to do.
No, that's silly. What these legislators need to know is who their constituents are. They don't have to gain a million followers on Instagram to be able to put their message across. Because at the end, the voters who love AOC, they're not going to be voting in Nebraska. They're not going to be voting in the more moderate areas. I'll give you a quick example from my own Orange County, California. So we have one of the rising rock stars in the House with Katie Porter. Everyone loves her on Real Time with Bill Maher, challenging God knows how many CEOs, not necessarily, you know, a protege of Elizabeth Warren. It works for her district, which is around Irvine, a lot of college educated, mostly white folks. But that's not going to work in the 39th district up in northern Orange County, where Gil Cisneros is probably going to lose to Young Kim, because that's a more conservative district. And by the way, it's also a more diverse district. It's an equal parts white, Asian, and Latino. And that message of socialism and populism is definitely not working in the 48th congressional district, where Harley Ruda is going to lose to Michelle Steele, who is not just a Republican. She actually found the one plank that definitely wins in Orange County, which is being a coronavirus skeptic. So by Harley Ruda, in fact, Harley Ruda knew this in his ads. He's, you know, his ads were, I could work with both Democrats and Republicans. I'm not about party. I'm not about partisanship. And that's not a message that won him, but only because Michelle Steele is so rabidly Republican that that's what the voters in that district want.
I mean, the irony here is that the smaller Democratic majority is going to be more liberal. This is what I saw happen with Republicans last decade. This does create more dysfunction, because this means the liberal wing has more control in this party, at the same time that the few moderates left think the liberal wing is what's killing their hopes to hold on to the majority.
Yeah, I mean, I think the frustration is that Democrats who didn't say defund the police, whose position was not that they wanted to defund the police, got tagged with this, and a lot of them were sort of at a loss about how to push back on that. I mean, I think Biden did a relatively good job of this and, you know, kept, you know, saying, well, I don't want to defund the police. In fact, I want more federal funding for police departments. It's the president who's trying to cut funding for police departments. And I think that sold it some of the way. But I think some of it is about tone. You want to be somewhere in between where Biden was, and Biden did better at this than a lot of other Democrats at distancing himself from these unpopular positions. Between that and where Abigail Spanberger was, you know, cursing out her fellow members on this conference call, that you need to sort of, you need to flash a little bit more irritation and show that not only do you disagree with the people saying this, but that what they're saying, that it offends you or that it really goes against your values. And I think that signals to those voters that, you know, that you really, that you're not just paying lip service, that you really do disagree with the farther left positions of people within your party. Of course, the problem with that, as Tim notes, is this is going to be a narrower majority. They're going to need everybody's vote to move things through the House with this narrow Democratic majority. And so you're going to have to worry about defections both on the left and on the center. I think that's going to be mitigated a little bit by the likely Republican majority in the Senate, which is to say legislation that moves is going to need Republican buy-in to get through the Senate. So you'll be able to rely on some Republican votes to move things through the House as well. But before we go to break, I want to ask about what it's going to be like for Biden to govern with this divided Congress, a narrow majority in the House for Democrats, probably a narrow majority for Republicans in the Senate. Tim, I hear a lot of liberals talk about this with complete despair and basically say, you know, McConnell's not going to confirm any judges that Joe Biden puts up. He's not going to put people in the cabinet, or he's going to make a lot of demands about exactly who Joe Biden can put in the cabinet. They're not going to be able to move any legislation. What is your prediction for how this Republican Senate is going to work with a Democratic president?
I don't think there's going to be significant blocking of the cabinet. I mean, there's always controversial nominees, and I think that that will play out as normal. On judges, my brothers and I were joking that electing Pelosi speaker, Biden president, clearly Americans want elderly leaders. So McConnell should confirm any judge who's over the age of 75. But on a serious note, yeah, I think there are lots of judges that McConnell will be happy to confirm. I mean, Merrick Garland specifically to the Supreme Court, I would say, but also the circuit court, the lower district court nominees, Republicans haven't blocked those. On circuit court, when Obama was in charge, they didn't block 100% of them. I think it'll look a lot like Barack Obama's last 2 years when Republicans had control of Congress, which was that they're not going to block everything. They are going to block a lot. And going into 2022 is actually a better year for Democrats in the Senate than Republicans. And so there's going to be an eye on states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Iowa that could be tough for Republicans to hold those seats.
You know, I'm actually a little bit more optimistic than many on the left are. I mean, you do have to remember also, they're not all just old. They're all part of the same tribe, actually, at this point. Biden, Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, they're all part of the same legislative tribe. They sort of get how it works. There was even a day a long time ago, but still, in which Mitch McConnell described Joe Biden as a real friend. And I think that, you know, there is some advantage to that. Unlike Barack Obama, Joe Biden isn't a young Black man who has taken the presidency for the first time in a way that has shocked and upset many on the right. There may actually be more opportunities for cooperation because they do, in fact, understand each other in some way. And I think that's actually kind of a sad fact, but I am hopeful that that makes governing a little bit easier.
The left definitely lost this election, but we'll see if they're actually going to end up winning the war. Going to Tim's point in 2022, if Georgia goes blue for both of the Senate seats, I still think it's going to be a spirit bipartisanship because that's all the Democrats really can do with this election. They don't have the left party, the left side does not have the mandate that they thought they would. But let's see what's going to happen in the future as younger voters who do seem to swing left are just waiting to get older. Maybe not all the way to 68, but definitely get older.
Yeah. I mean, my view view is I think Joe Biden can have a productive working relationship with a divided Congress. I think partly for the reasons that Christine notes. Biden was the guy that the Obama administration would send up to negotiate with Republicans on the Hill because he had the best relationships with them. And I think, Christine, as you note, there's a variety of reasons for that, some of which are kind of sad, some of which have to do with Biden having been in the Senate for decades and having really deep personal relationships with these folks. So I think that's possible. But the agenda that he can get through, I mean, I think we're probably going to be looking back to a lot of the sort of stuff we saw in the late 90s with Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress, which is finding smaller bore popular initiatives that you can sell to a broad set of the political spectrum. This is not going to be a policy agenda that makes the left really happy because they don't have the votes to enact that. But I think it could be a policy agenda that ends up making Joe Biden pretty popular, especially because I think 2021 is going to be a pretty good year in America. The vaccine will be rolling out. We will be rolling back a lot of the restrictions that we've had on our lives this year. The economy will be continuing to grow quickly. And so I think it's possible that the positive environment that Biden will get an updraft from will help him politically, and also that positive environment will be producing economic gains and make it a little bit easier to avoid certain difficult decisions. So I'm hopeful in that regard, but then I'm a centrist. And, you know, we're not going to be getting a big corporate tax increase. We're not going to be getting a lot of the big new government programs that Democrats have been hoping they might be able to do with full control. Let's leave it there on that this week. I want to thank Gustavo Arellano, Los Angeles Times columnist and KCRW contributor. Gustavo, thank you for coming back on the show this week.
Gracias, as always.
I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. We will be back with Stephen Shepard, Politico's campaign and elections editor, to talk about what went wrong with the polling. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts. Or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. So the polls were wrong. We don't know how wrong yet. And I do want to note, as the time it takes to count votes has gotten longer, with more and more states doing more mail-in voting, the picture we have of the results the day after the election is often several points different than the final picture once all the votes are counted. So in a lot of states, it's premature to measure the performance of the polls. We don't really know what the result is in California right now, let alone in Arizona or Nevada. We don't know how large Joe Biden's national win margin is going to be, and therefore how off the national polls were. But we do know near-final results in a number of states, and it is not pretty for the pollsters. 538 had Biden to win Florida by 2.5 points. The president appears to have won it by 3.5, so that's a miss of 6 points. Biden took Wisconsin by less than 1 point. The polls told you he was likely to win there by 8, so that's an even larger miss, way off. In fact, this is looking to be an even worse cycle for polling than 2016 was. Back then, the national polls did show Donald Trump closing at the end. They only overstated Hillary Clinton's support by a point or two at the end. The error was larger in the upper Midwest states, but even that year, the polls showed the late movement toward Trump that was the big story of that election that allowed him to win. And this year, aside from one major poll, the Ann Selzer poll of Iowa that showed Trump closing big at the end, we really got no warning of that from most of the pollsters. And so to talk about that, Stephen Shepard joins us now. Steve is Politico's senior campaign and elections editor and their chief polling analyst. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So Steve, before we talk about why the polls were wrong, can you give us your analysis about what we know so far about how wrong they were?
So we know that they were wrong, and they were wrong in the same direction they were wrong in 2016. You mentioned that we don't know what the national popular vote margin is going to be, whether it's Joe Biden's currently ahead by 3 points. It's probably there are, 4 million votes to count out of California. So the thought is that he will win the popular vote by maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 points, somewhere in that range. The final polling average had him up by 8.5. We're talking about a larger miss at the national level. And then you went state by state. And I really think it's instructive to look at the states where we do have a resolution. You mentioned Florida and Wisconsin. I would also point to Ohio, where the final polling average had Trump ahead by a point, and he appears to have won by roughly 8. There are Michigan, where the final polls had Joe Biden up by 8. He appears to have won by 3. This is the same sort of error that I think we saw in 2016. And I know it's an error that in talking to a lot of pollsters over the last 4 years, they spent a lot of time and a lot of energy thinking about how to fix it. And it doesn't seem like what they did worked in this case.
So after 2016, the story that we all heard about what was wrong with the polls, especially in the Midwest, was that they weren't weighted by education. That if you call people up on the phone to survey them, they're a lot more likely to answer you if they have a college degree. And so it used to be that white voters voted about the same whether they had a college degree or not, and it didn't really matter very much whether too many of the white voters you were surveying were college educated. But then as we've had this education polarization where whites with college degrees have gotten more Democratic, whites without college degrees have gotten more Republican, that this was screwing up the polls, especially in places like Wisconsin that really have a lot of white voters without college degrees. And it was supposed to be the pollsters were like, okay, we got it. That's a problem. We're going to fix this. We're going to weight by education. We'll get it right this time. And they did that weighting and they were still wrong. So do you have a sense of why that didn't fix it, what it is that's biasing these polls?
That's a great distillation of the post-2016 diagnosis. The pollsters that I've talked to so far, first of all, always caution that we need to wait a little bit to see just how off these are going to be in some of these states. Obviously, for example, Pennsylvania, where the poll showed Joe Biden up by 5 points, the election result is a moving target that has been shifting wildly over the past couple of days and appears to be turning in a decisive direction for Joe Biden. I think what is going to happen over the next couple of months is a more intensive effort to look and comb through some of the voter files in these states to see who voted and who didn't, and who the pollsters were reaching and who they weren't. And the one thing we already know from the results that have been counted so far, even with millions of votes left to count, is that turnout was much, much higher in this election than in 2016. Both, even with all these votes still left to count, both Joe Biden and President Trump have easily exceeded the vote counts of their respective party nominees in 2016. So it does appear that both candidates motivated huge swaths of voters who stayed home in 2016. And it's possible that the polls, at least for the president's voters who came out, who were not active in 2016, that the polls missed them entirely. That may be what happens, and they're going to go through these voter files and figure out who stayed home and who turned out.
Tim, it's been a funny cycle for polling for conservatives, or at least the way they've talked about polling, because you had these outlets like Trafalgar that had very opaque models that were supposed to be sort of like adjusting for shy Trump voters and coming in several points to the right of the pollsters that do polls for media outlets and saying, you know, the polls are wrong, they're missing our voters. At the same time, the private polls that the campaigns were commissioning to figure out where to spend money and where they were going to win, the Republican internal polls seem to have been just as badly off as Democratic polls, that Republicans inside their campaigns, they didn't believe the skewed poll messaging that you heard maybe on Fox News. They believed that Democrats were on pace to win big in this election. So it seems this isn't just a media problem. It's even the Republicans' own pollsters seem to have missed this.
No, I do think that the story you just told is a very standard story of our day, which is that the media kind of fails. And so some people on the right try to come up with an alternative model, which is jerry-rigged and far worse. And that's what I think, or worse. And that's what you see in the polls. And I think the problem, the story you told about adjusting for non-college votes, I think the original interpretation, which didn't offer a great solution 4 years ago, was maybe there's something about Trump supporters specifically that makes them less likely to respond to pollsters. That is, they have lower levels of trust, and no pollster is going to be able to deal with that. If you have a correlated non-response with a specific candidate, then I don't see how anybody comes up with a good system. And I guess that would be my question for Steve. Is it just possible that non-college voters who supported Trump were less likely to respond than non-college voters who didn't support Trump?
I talked to Patrick Murray at Monmouth University, who's one of the academic pollsters who really took the challenge of diving into these battleground states. You know, one of the problems in 2016 was among all of them, was that we didn't have enough quality polling in the battleground states. A lot of the national media outlets spent their money and energy on national surveys. So Monmouth and I can name the New York Times and Siena College, ABC News and the Washington Post, they all put a lot of money into these state polls this time around. Patrick told me that he thought that it might be something unique to Trump, that this was not necessarily a systematic problem that would affect them that we saw in the 2018 midterms, for example, with the exception of some individual states, but that there's something about the name Donald Trump on the ballot makes people not want to engage with pollsters ahead of that election.
Christine, we were talking earlier about the fight within the Democratic Party about which messages were appealing and weren't appealing and whether you need to project a more progressive image and try to turn out more voters, although we did have very strong turnout this time, or whether you need to project a more moderate image and try to win over swing voters. And I think part of the problem for having that argument is that if the polls are wrong, and if the efforts that you take to figure out, you know, what do voters actually think, what messages will convince them, which candidates are going to be more popular, if you can't rely on those polls, then I don't know how you conduct that internal debate within the party, because nobody really knows what's a winning message.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I will remain curious about the question of the shy Trump voter, and also the slight mystery, to me at least, of how closely Trump managed to tie himself to the identity of his voters and supporters. Because I do think that, you know, it might have been possible to actually do some research and find out what people think on specific policies, on specific statements, etc. But because Donald Trump made this into such a sort of like cultural and personal referendum, tied himself so tightly to every question, I think even for like the best pollster, it might have been hard to separate out how people feel about certain policies or certain statements apart from Donald Trump. I wonder if in the future that will become clearer, I guess, once the air is cleared of, you know, this figure who has sort of been clouding it up for the past 4 years. But I just don't know. And I think that actually also one thing that Democrats need to do, and something that Gustavo was saying earlier, is to rely less on, you know, technocracy and sort of polls and distant science, and actually, you know, continue to get down, you know, go and talk to the constituents, learn the voters in their district, and see what people, real people who actually cast ballots, tell them that they care about in person, not just what, you know, science brings on the wind.
Steve, to Christine's point there about whether there's something specific about Trump and how he affects these polls, I assume that's a big question that pollsters are going to have to wrestle with as they do their postmortem of what they got wrong this time. How do they figure out what problems are persistent and what problems may be specific to Donald Trump? Because if he's less of a political figure in 2022 and 2024, which is uncertain but possible, and you make adjustments to the polls based on what happened this time, and you have to figure out are these adjustments that are persistent that we need to make ongoing, or were there specific Trump problems? Because if you adjust out for the Trump problems and Trump isn't there, it seems like you could overcorrect. It seems like that's yet another thing making life more difficult for these pollsters.
Well, and that's the thing. I talked with a lot of pollsters ahead of this election, and one of their big concerns was that they had overcorrected already from 2016. And when you look at the differences in the states that have reported their votes thus far, it's clear that that concern was unfounded. I think that there are a number of different experiments that they can conduct, whether that means surveying more people rather than by telephone, where you'd have a conversation with another human being. It's a more anonymous experience, whether that's online, by text message, or by an automated phone call. Experiments like that might be better able to gauge people's true feelings. But the problem, you know, a lot of them have tried all of that, and there didn't seem to be much of a shy Trump effect. When you test these different methodologies, the problem seems to be that a lot of these folks just aren't participating at all, regardless of how you want to, even if you want to provide them a completely anonymous experience. The other thing I want to mention is, you know, we're talking about some of the policies and some of the issue polling here. Obviously, tens of millions of eligible voters, even as high as turnout was in this election, did not vote. However, among people who did, when you look at some of the exit polling, which is, of course, weighted to the election result, and so we can have a little bit more confidence in that, especially after all these votes are counted, it does seem like we need to reconfigure some of our understanding of where the American people are on some big issues. Particularly, I'm thinking of the coronavirus pandemic and the president's response to it. If you look at the exit polling, and again, these numbers will be adjusted in the coming weeks, It shows a little bit more support for the president's approach to the pandemic than you might expect, rather than some of the pre-election surveys and other issue polls that show the public essentially aligned 60-40 against how the president has handled this. Instead, it shows that a little bit closer, 55-45, 52-48, something a little bit more divided, and something that, quite frankly, matches a little bit closer to what the popular vote result is going to be in this election. Look, obviously, the people who don't participate in the election, their opinions still matter to some degree, but they don't really matter as much. And I think pollsters will need to find a solution that isn't just about the 2022 election and the 2024 election, but it's about figuring this out sooner so that we have a better idea of what American people think. Because polling is not just about predicting elections. It is the opportunity, as an American citizen, you only get to weigh in on the course of your federal government every 2 years and on the course of the executive branch every 4 years. Polling is the opportunity for the voice of the people to be heard. If Joe Biden is declared the winner of this election and takes office on January 20th, he's going to be confronting some major challenges in taking office. And the American people have an opportunity to weigh in on how he's doing and how he should approach things and which policies and which direction he should take. And polling's our best way to do that, at least until the 2022 election. So these are problems that have to be fixed.
That's one of the things that's been eating away at me as I watch this poll error, is that polling isn't just about elections. It's also not just about politics. The unemployment rate is determined through a survey. Consumer confidence is a survey. Corporations go out and they do market research, try to figure out what products and services to sell. Should we worry that all of that stuff is wrong? That this isn't limited to election and political polling, that all sorts of stuff where we're asking people things, we're just not getting the right answers?
I do worry about that, because there are signs in America, in Americans' declining trust in institutions, that I think can be pervasive through all these things that you talked about. And, if that keeps degrading the amount of trust that the American people have in institutions, whether those institutions are the news media, their government, their political leaders, bureaucracy, which has been a little bit under attack over the past couple of decades, that could lead to declining participation in things like this, inaccuracies in things like this. I know that this isn't just in one direction or among one party. However, I think the declining trust in institutions has kind of numerous downstream effects, and this may be one of them.
Stephen Shepherd is Politico's campaign and elections editor and chief polling analyst. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Josh.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across political spectrum. Tim Carney, what's your rant?
I agree that Americans' declining trust in institutions is a big problem, and the days after Election Day showed exactly why. I spent some of my time trying to convince conservative friends that there is not a massive voter fraud campaign of hundreds of thousands of votes. But you know what? It would be nice at this point if we had a national media or that hadn't spent its last 4 years lighting its authority on fire. When CNN frankly states there is no massive voter fraud, or even worse, there is no voter fraud, which is clearly a false statement, we can't help but remember it was a year ago that Anderson Cooper said, and I quote, "President Trump has falsely accused your son," that is Hunter Biden, "of doing something wrong while serving on a company board in Ukraine." That is, Anderson Cooper, the news reporter, expressed his opinion as frankly a fact that can't be disputed. And so now when those same people come out and say simply there is no voter fraud, even when those reporters are right to say that, they have lost credibility. And when Twitter will say if you tweet about coronavirus but it disagrees with the World Health Organization, but then we realize the World Health Organization is pretty wrong and possibly corrupt in what they're saying about coronavirus, then suddenly it becomes impossible to reach out to people in this important point and say trust the democracy, trust the system. The state governments, the county governments are not cheating to try to hand this to Biden. I want the states and the counties to convince the people this is true. I wish they hadn't spent so many years blowing up their credibility to do so.
Gustavo Arellano, let's bring you back for a rant. What's on your mind?
Please, 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 networks, whether you're on broadcast or cable, please get more Latino pundits. I'm going through Fox News. I'm going through CNN. I'm going through MSNBC. And I'm hearing so much talk about what we always talk about every presidential election, the Latino vote. But it's not Latinos who are talking about it. I'm sorry, but Ana Navarro cannot be the one spokesperson for all Latinos, especially in this election where you've seen that there's such a diversity of thought. So please hire or get like your consultants or even get one-offs. And it doesn't have to be me. Trust me, it doesn't have to be me. Get somebody like Gerardo Cadava. He's a professor at Northwestern University. He published a book this year about the history of Latino Republicans. Brilliant book. And sadly, none of the networks were smart enough to get him on. But you know who was smart enough to get him on? Trevor Noah. Diversity matters. Representation matters. Do it.
Christine Emba, it's your soapbox.
This is going to be a little bit meta, I think, because my brain is fried. But come on, brain. I knew that this extended vote count nail-biter situation was likely. I mean, on a panel just last week, I was the one calmly suggesting that Americans would need to sit tight and stay calm. And yet, somehow, in my heart, I still believed that America would get it together, stand up and say no loudly and clearly, and that we would be shut of Donald Trump early. Come on, Emba. Haven't you learned that America will break your heart? I mean, you saw this after you cast your first vote for Barack Obama, and instead of celebrating how far we'd come, Mitch McConnell, that ghoul set up to obstruct every good thing. You knew this in 2016 as America elected a vicious, venal, incompetent con man out of revenge. And now in 2020, white women like Donald Trump even more than they do in 2016. Hunter Biden, for some reason, matters compared to everything that Donald Trump has gotten up to over the past 3.5 years. Nearly half of America is going to see 250,000 people die in a pandemic. 500 plus kids lose their parents. White nationalists marching in the streets and say, yeah, this, actually, I like this. I want more of this. I know it's going to be fun to make fun of glum winners, but it's sad. This is sad to see and know that this is who we are. It's who we are. It's who we've always been. I'm steeling myself, as we all should, to work and make this country better. I still think we can. Biden is, in the end, I think, going to eke it out. But I'm mad and disappointed that I let myself be surprised. Complacency is not an option anymore.
For my rant, first, a mini rant about the exit polls. We don't know how many white women voted for Donald Trump, and we won't know that for about 18 months. In 2016, the figure that we got from the exit polls ended up being off by 5 points. So I just want to I want to reserve most of our judgment about which demographic groups voted which ways. You can impute some things from precincts and that sort of thing, but we will have a much clearer picture of exactly how Donald Trump lost 18 months from now than we have now when we have the better survey data. The other thing I want to say to Democrats is smile. You won. And if you spent 4 years looking at Donald Trump saying, how can this guy be popular? How can our country have elected this guy president? He was never popular. He didn't win the popular vote last time, and this time he has lost it by enough that he is losing the election. You won. You're getting rid of this guy. We're going to have a president who we don't need to be constantly embarrassed by all the time. You're going to get significant policy gains, even though you're not going to get the ones that you were expecting if you took back the entirety of Congress. So this is a good outcome, and I realize, like everybody else, I saw Florida come in first. How is it that Florida is the best state in the country at counting votes? How is it that they're the ones that were able to tell us within, you know, mere hours of the polls closing how badly Joe Biden had done in Florida? But that was, you know, that was just Florida. Nationally, Biden has, you know, has outperformed what I think we should have expected for a candidate running in an environment where people approved of the president on the economy. He managed to defeat the incumbent, and he has saved us from Donald Trump. And so this is a good outcome. This was a good week. It's going to be a good next year. And I just want to say, please be happy. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Christine Emba, Tim Carney, Gustavo Arellano, and Stephen Shepard. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.